shaking like a leaf on a tree that's coming loose from the stem. Shaking like a leaf on a tree, because I'm coming loose of my man. I'm like a weeping willow, weeping on my pillow. For years and years there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my ba da da ba ba da ba ba da ba 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 da ba da. Down and down he dragged me, like a fiend he nagged me. For years and years there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my ba da da ba da da da. Although I may be blue, still I'm through. I must tell him goodbye, rather than have that man gonna lay me down and just die. Oh, broken-hearted sisters, aggravated misters, lend me your ears, there ain't no sweet man that's worth the salt of my ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da ba da da ba da.
Cobwebs in your hand, you're getting rusty, so you say. You're feeling badly, and everything looks gray and sad. You're getting worried, yes indeed. I know exactly what you need. A little sunshine will make you feel okay. Now look here, give the blues a change. Find a sunny place, go and paint your face. Sunshine, pay your doctor bill, throw away his pill. You can cure your ill with sunshine.
Why don't you take your teardrops one by one before it gets too late? Hang them up out in the sun and they'll evaporate.
When the trouble starts pounding at your heart, rub the injured part with sunshine.
Thank you.
Lordy, how they play it. Boy, they really sway it.
Okay, thank you, Bix. Thank you, Bing. I just know that I was playing some continuous music, but it took the expertise of our ops director. Yes, we actually left one or two people on salary staff here. I think actually there's a total of seven. And in so doing, we got this going. I will begin my show, but I have to say that I got a tweet, or rather a Facebook message, from a listener. My message was not sent to the connectivity here. It's pretty awful, with some very, very, very sad news for people in the world of science fiction. Had I but known this, I would have changed the agenda for tonight. But Lucius Shepard, one of the great writers in SF, somebody who's been on this show two or three times, once just to talk about movies, and regular reader at, he's read at least once for the reading series I produced, before I produced it, the New York Review of Science Fiction, and several times for KGB. And, he has died. In brief, I don't know any details beyond that other than this is a sad occasion. So let me finally start Hour of the Wolf. Let's see if we can get this thing going now. Takes a long time, but it might just happen. Come on. Do it, little player.
Thank you.
are problems, but hopefully we have dealt with them. This is Hour of the Wolf, sort of. My name is Jim Freund. We are going to be listening to an interview that I conducted on Sunday with Raymond E. Feist, one of the greats in science fiction. We're also going to hear first a review of a recent movie. I think we can all get it in, just barely, and I apologize for all the technical issues that we're dealing with this morning. Anyhow, I pledge we won't have them too much. Stay tuned. Okay, I had something else queued up at that point. And I think, oh, it's just repeating, isn't it? Hold on, we'll move on to our review.
Second year in a row we are attempting
to... No. I apologize. Boy, do I apologize. Let's see what's happening here. It would seem that we have so many different sources playing so many different things. Okay, so, one of these years, it would be lovely, lovely, lovely to get back into a real studio with turntables, don't you think? Yeah. Okay, let's try this now and see if that comes up. There seem... Ah, two things are labeled the same. That's my fault. There we go.
Last year, 2013, wasn't the greatest for animated film. Nothing coming from the big studios really distinguished itself. How bad was 2013? Frozen won the Oscar. Remember, kids, to send your email comments to danstasteisuphisbutt@mightymoviepodcast.com. That's danstasteisuphisbutt@mightymoviepodcast.com. Frozen was a good film. The animation was beautiful, and it had some very good songs, although not the one that won the Oscar. Once again, email, comments, danstasteisuphisbutt@mightymoviepodcast.com. It's just that Frozen wasn't the best film that year. Now, I haven't seen The Wind Rises, so I can't comment on that, but I have finally seen Ernest and Celestine, and I can tell you, everything that Frozen tries to be, Ernest and Celestine actually is. And what's surprising is how wrong first impressions of this French-Belgian film can be. If you've seen stills of the picture book-like imagery, or heard the plot summed up as a bear and mouse overcoming the prejudices of their world to strike up a friendship, you might be convinced you have this film pegged. Good thing to sit the kids down in front of, important lesson to be learned. Fine, good. You'd be wrong. Ernest and Celestine has three directors. One, Benjamin Renner, is making his feature film debut. The other two, Stéphane Aubier and Vincent Pittard, previously created the frenetic and gleefully silly stop-motion film A Town Called Panic, which, among other things, had a toy horse learning the piano, a pair of cowboy and Indian figures planning a barbecue, and a giant robotic penguin. The directors have toned things down a bit here, but Ernest and Celestine does have a similar comedic sense that's all the more intriguing for being simultaneously anarchic and genuinely sweet. The young orphan mouse Celestine and the bear Ernest are both loose cannons in their respective subterranean mouse city and above-ground bear society, both of which seem to run on some sort of tooth-based economy. It doesn't help that there's no little enmity between these two communities for obvious predator and prey reasons. Celestine manages to bond with Ernest essentially through a set of mutual crimes. She goads him into raiding the basement of a candy shop, then helps him escape from police custody. He reciprocates by assisting in a raid on a shop in the Bear City that sells replacement teeth, thus helping Celestine get in good with the dentist she's apprenticed to. In a film of talking bears and mice, you're going to obsess over a mouse dentist? Get over it. It's a crime wave that eventually has them both holing up in Ernest's secluded cabin, although to hear the officials of both worlds describe it, the crime has less to do with thievery and more to do with that forbidden friendship. Society just can't survive if mouse and bear start getting along. The design of Ernest and Celestine takes off from the original storybook illustrations by Gabriel Vincent, and they are lovely, but it's the animation, a kind of expressive staccato choreography that bursts with life, that sets this film apart, that makes it more than just an animate storybook. The distributors, meanwhile, have pulled together a great cast for the English language version. Forrest Whitaker voices Ernest. Also in there are Paul Giamatti, William H. Macy, Jeffrey Wright, Megan Mullally, and where Megan Mullally goes, Nick Offerman cannot be far behind. He's here as well. Lauren Bacall, for Christ's sake, is in there. Just a great cast. I stay away from the term charming because it's a loaded word for me. It's what's used when you want to convince people to abandon some form of critical judgment. You don't need to do that with Ernest and Celestine. It manages to be genuinely charming, visually expressive, and gently subversive all at once. It's pure, surprising, fantasy fun, and it's really, really good. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and or horror film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Okay. Ooh, there's a buzz in this microphone. I gotta tell you, I cannot wait to see Ernest and Celestine. I love A Town Called Panic. Both the feature film, which was distributed by Aardman, and also a series of shorts. They are simply mind-boggling in their strangeness. And this film sounds, sorry Dan, charming. One way or the other, I'm a huge fan of that kind of thing. I don't think that Frozen came close to being Oscar-worthy as a great movie. Unfortunately, Pixar didn't put out anything good. Aardman didn't put out anything distributed in the U.S. I believe Ernest and Celestine is about to open. Another movie worth noting, by the way, is Yaudarowski's Dune. It's either at Film Forum or at IFC. It's about to open within the next couple of days. And for those who don't know, Yaudarowski was this, he made El Topo, and I think it was the Iron Mountain. He makes David Lynch look mainstream in his work. And so it's interesting stuff. Okay, so this runs, about 55 minutes, and we'd better get to it. This that I'm referring to is an interview I conducted with Raymond E. Feist. I had never met Ray before until we were actually sitting down and doing the interview. Usually, people who come on this program, if I haven't met them, I want to, spend a little time with them before the show and warm up, as it were. And we are hoping to do this to a teeming crowd of fans at Lunacon. But alas, we really didn't have the time. So, I'm sorry, the time slot that was as desirable was at the convention was beginning to wind down. And the person who was in the room before us basically was not quite cognizant of the fact that his time had elapsed. One second, I'm just taking a look here. Yes, okay, 52 minutes is how long it runs. So we're okay. So I dispensed with a proper introduction because most people attending Lunacon would know who Ray Feist is. But let me tell you, he is author of some 31 books in a single universe. And usually, with a lot of writers, including Robert Jordan and all that, this becomes repetitive and boring. I once was reading through the Robert Jordan cycle of books, and there are about 12 now being after his death being finished by Brandon Sanderson. And yeah, I enjoyed the first book, and the second book was okay. But by the third book, I was saying, okay, this is the same thing. One book was in the forest, another book was in a town, the third book was on a desert, and you have a few guest villains and characters and stuff like that. But it gets essentially boring. Well, at one point, I picked up Magician by Raymond E. Feist, and I read through that trilogy, which became known as the Rift War cycle. And then there was another trilogy, and another, some of them in collaboration with different writers by Jenny Wirtz. And I've got to tell you, it does not flag an interest. They keep coming, he keeps going. And how these books came to be, and all that, is included in the interview, which seems to have started without me, so I can go back and hit that stop button. Okay, now you just wait, and we'll get to you. You know what? I'm going to be real careful and make sure that's the only thing in the queue that can possibly play. We're dealing there. There is a name for the kind of technical difficulties that we are finding here in the control room, and it's Meshuggah. Okay? Aha! And I left the wrong one. Okay, so let me go here. And here it says Ray Feist, Lunacon. And set your way back machine. I've been saying this for years, so no, this is hardly a reference to the new Peabody and Sherman movie. This is a reference to proper time travel, as Jay Ward would have had it. And it's to last Sunday. We were supposed to start at noon. Instead, we started at about 12:15. And we were supposed to end at 1 sharp because they were breaking down. Instead, we ended up at about 1:07. You will hear me. I didn't edit it out. Somebody, you know, giving me a time signal that my time was up. And you'll hear me saying, no, we're continuing. Because we were let in 15 minutes late. And I'm recording an hour for a 90-minute show. Or what was a 90-minute show. So, let me first do a break, since it is but 7 seconds before 2 a.m. in New York City. 2 a.m. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica radio at 99.5 FM, at least for the nonce. And the program is Hour of the Wolf. Now we're started properly, at least. My name is Jim Freund, and we now... Oh, and please, after after all this, I'm going to ask you to pledge. Yes, I've got chutzpah. 212-209-2950, please. Pledge $10 to become a BAI buddy. That's $10 a month, and you'll get all kinds of gifts and good karma for doing that. Okay, is your Wayback Machine set for Sunday? I thought it was. Here we go.
So actually, the second year in a row, we are attempting to actually record a radio program here at Lunacon. My name is Jim Freund. I host a radio program called Hour of the Wolf, which has been on the air since 1972. And even before that, when I was 13 years old, I was doing various work in radio, specifically science fiction fantasy. I have interviewed many of the great writers in the world, but not all, because one person I haven't interviewed is Raymond E. Feist. A.K.A. Ray, I understand?
That's fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen it on the Sufwa areas, which I lurk within. I will have already given your credits on the air, and I assume most people here know who Ray Feist is? Yes, okay. That seems like a fair assumption. So, dive right in. As part of diving right in, we could talk about anything from writers' rights to your legal knowledge about the way writers need to deal with their publishers to the Rift War, those are the same thing, sorry.
That's the rights war.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing I am not competent, no, well, among the things that I'm not competent to discuss are football.
Okay.
But let us start with your interests. Let's start with gaming.
I started off gaming primarily for social reasons. A few friends of mine at college were vanishing every Thursday night, and were never available for dinner or hanging out or whatever. And I finally said, "Where are you guys going every Thursday?" They said, "Oh, we're going over to this guy's house. He and his roommate run this game every Thursday night called Dungeons and Dragons." And I said, "That sounds pretty weird." But I tagged along, and mostly I really enjoyed the people. So I got involved in it as a method for, socializing. Because, you're a starving student in college, you're always looking for cheap entertainment. And
so if you're in college, this is about 15 years ago?
Oh, thank you very much for that, my friend. Closer to 40. The end-all be-all of it was that I got enmeshed in this world of Minkemia and the games we played in it.
Now, the world already had that name.
Oh, yeah. It was a virtual world before I got there. It wasn't as fleshed out as it was by the time I started writing. By the time I started writing Magician, we had already added very large areas to the world map and created new cities and dungeons and all the things you do in the gaming environment. And then I made the decision to not write about the game era because it was too confined, too constrained.
Jack Chalker did one. He was going to do a lot of sequels and opted not to for that reason.
Well, so what I did was I went back 500 years in the history of the planet. So I was writing virtually historical novels about a place that didn't exist. And the nice thing about it is that it allowed me to target, if it goes far enough, then we'll get into why the world looked the way it did, in the gaming era. So I started 500 years back, and by the time I finished Magician's End, we were about 300 years back, and 250, 300. And the beginning of what became the environment that I played in took place in the last book. And it was pretty nice because I had a tremendous amount of freedom to make what I would of other people's creations. So that the Empire of Great Kesh, as I wrote about it, was very different than the Empire of Great Kesh that existed during the game era. The same with the three cities, the kingdom and Roldom and all that. And I took advantage of that. I gave free rein to my mad impulses and just put stuff in there where the people who gamed with me would kind of go, "Huh? What? I don't remember that." Yeah, because I just made it up.
First obvious question, which is a variant on the where do you sci-fi writers get your crazy ideas from, the answer of which, by the way, if any listeners don't know, is Schenectady.
Oh, I thought it was Perth.
No, Schenectady.
Oh, okay. Or Peoria, someplace, yeah.
No. Okay. It's closer to New York. It's
that's the company that sends you three a month and you keep the one you like and send the other two back?
No, that must be
that's Peoria, yeah.
No, this is a lockbox. There you go into and you blindly reach in and there's your next book.
Ah, I see.
So, or at least your next idea. The question at hand is really, okay, D&D has its charms and its immersive nature, but it does not have the wealth of imagination that becomes Magician and all that, and ultimately the cycle and all of the franchises that the Rift War books are.
Well, that's a fair observation, and I believe it's, you know, fairly simple to explain, which is that, you know, Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson weren't creating a literary environment, they were creating a gaming environment, and they tried to do some things with backstories, and then once the franchise got really seriously rich, and they came out with the whole Advanced Dungeons & Dragons editions, that's when they started, you know, doing things like the book tie-ins and creating a massive world with some nuance and some, you know, kind of history to it. Whereas what I was doing was just taking an environment and then, you know, saying, fine, I've got a, you know, I could have written about the outback of Australia, for example, and then just put whatever silly story I wanted in there. And that's the difference.
Yes, but your name isn't Robert Jordan.
This is true.
Sorry. Listeners can see my face.
Yeah, Jim was an old friend, and
I interviewed him. He was we're on airtime now, but I can tell you a couple of stories. Yeah. He was wonderful, but I mean, he looked down the corridor to make sure that I didn't have bunches of fans following me.
Well, the thing you have to understand too is that unless you really knew him well, you interviewed Robert Jordan. He was a character that Jim played, and he used to do some stuff that I found amusing as hell that would annoy the devil out of people, and I remember going to a couple of book signings where they're kind of going like, okay, you know, and you're not like Robert Jordan, right? Okay, no, I won't bust you because you have the wrong brand of bottled water. You know, I mean, he used to do nonsense
Yeah. Okay, but
getting back to your question, the fact was is that I wasn't, you know, trying to create a gaming product to sell to people with polyhedral dice. I was creating a book to read. So the tasks were entirely different. You know, what Gary and Dave were doing were building a gaming environment that really sang to a lot of people because a lot of people bought the products and created their environments and went crazy with it. And it spawned a lot of imitators. I mean, if, you know...
Those, oh, God, yes.
Yeah, the people who are old enough to remember that era, you got to remember, you know, Chainmail and Tunnels and Trolls and Dragon Quest.
For me, Moon Quest, it was even more rudimentary. It was diplomacy.
Oh, yeah.
And we went from playing diplomacy, and I'm not a game player, but at Lunarians meetings, as a matter of fact, John Boardman, who was developing his own rules, some many of which are within the Gygax universe, everybody was playing D&D. So did I. But we had, like, our, you know, I won't say New York, Brooklyn set of rules.
Oh, yeah, everybody had a problem with that because, you know, I came to it, like I said, the game was already up and running. But originally it was a bunch of guys in the Triton Wargamer Society at UC San Diego who were playing medieval miniatures. And the original three pamphlet in a box set of rules from TSR were... In answer to the question, what if Gandalf had been in the Battle of Agincourt? You know, and it was that. It was a set of magic rules to integrate with chainmail. If you didn't know chainmail, the three pamphlets in the box were, like, incomprehensible. It took us weeks to figure out how to do certain things because of the way the rules were written. And as want, and I'm sure the same thing with your group, people started tossing rules and saying, okay, we can do a better combat system than that, or we can do a better magic system than that.
Actually, we were playing before the rule books were out.
Okay.
Before, and John Boardman worked at TSR.
Okay.
So we felt entitled.
And it was an interesting evolution, you know, because...
it's like, where did jazz start?
Yeah, exactly.
Similar kind of derivation story.
Yeah. But you know, the big thing about it, of course, is that you get creds for being the guy who got the brand out there. And David and Gary got the brand out there. And even, I mean, D&D became almost a generic, like Kleenex.
That's right.
You know, it was
almost.
Yeah, it was. It was like, you know, people would say very. I mean, people still say FRP, but you know. But the interesting thing for me is that I now play Warcraft with my kids. You know, World of Warcraft. My daughter's up in the Bay Area, and my son was, and he's now living with me, going to college in San Diego. So we would online game together because it was something we could do over a long distance. And I find it interesting how...
The unusual exception where online actually truly is social.
Well, it is a social thing. In fact, I met some of the guys from Blizzard over the years because they number quite a number of my fans. And I really had an interesting conversation at an E3 many years ago when the vanilla version of Warcraft was out. And I said, I'm really annoyed with the quest chain where at the end it's like, okay, now go get a party. And I go, you know, I play weird times of the day when I'm taking breaks from work or when my kids are online, and I can't always go get a party. And then the stock answer was always, well, you know, Warcraft is a social game. You're supposed to make friends. You're supposed to go out and play with other people, you know. And I thought, that's interesting because, you know, most game designs at that level would assume the opposite. That, okay, people are going to want to play this by themselves and then maybe go, you know. And now I look at the evolution of things like the guilds and the raiding groups and the way they keep tinkering it so that it makes it easier and easier to do social things. And I realized that they understood that there was a problem. But you're right. That's the thing about it as an online undertaking is that it is at its heart a very social. I mean, your guild group may number people from, you know, Atlanta to Antarctica. I mean, any place in between. I have some people that I play with in my guild who are in Australia, but they work weird hours.
Mm-hmm.
So it's convenient for them to be on an American server. You know, and a couple of guys from Europe, same thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that that's an interesting area for somebody else to explore. I don't have time, but there's got to be somebody out there writing a sociological paper on that.
Oh, I'm sure there have been, and I know a few people who go back far enough. But I'd rather get back, you know, but enough about you. Let's talk about you. because, Frank, I'm interested in gaming to an extent, and no Infocom game came out where it wasn't a part of the contract, actually, for them to come and do my radio show. So I love to talk about this stuff. But I haven't had the opportunity to talk to you before, and there's so much, and not necessarily about the Rift World things, but here is the question, which is, yes, okay, fine, our derivation is gaming, the germination comes out of there, but that doesn't teach you good storytelling,
no,
which
it doesn't.
Is frankly what got me into it, is I picked up the book, and it was a page-turner, okay? And then I don't do this with a lot of fantasy epics, but I find your work so blessedly readable and your character so interesting, and I'd like, you know, and that's not something you got from D&D.
No, it isn't. I got that primarily from being raised in Hollywood. My dad was a producer, director, writer.
That's right.
And named Felix E. Feist, and he started, you know, a very young age in Hollywood. He was 19 when he moved out from New York and started working at Fox. At Metro. And he was at MGM. And I think he directed his first feature when he was, you know, in his 20s. So an interesting science fiction film called Deluge about a tidal wave hitting New York.
And, yes, one of the many, I'm a New Yorker, one of the many times we have destroyed New York in cinema.
And it's,
and we can do it on radio.
And it was an odd film because, I mean, among other things, it was considered to be a breakthrough on a lot of levels in terms of special effects and things, and given the time.
That wasn't Irwin Allen, was it?
Oh, no. This is 30 years before Irwin.
Oh.
Yeah, this is 1933.
Again, and yet you only graduated school 15 years ago. Yeah. I don't know.
But I think that what's interesting for me is...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. Well, it was considered a lost film, you know. And then somebody discovered an Italian dub. And so I got a copy of it. Somebody emailed me a file. And so it's dubbed in Italian, but with English subtitles. So you kind of get an idea of what was going on with it at the time. And it's an interesting small film. It's quite exciting. And then he didn't do features for a while. Then he went into short subjects.
And at MGM, that's a major.
Well, it was at the time, a major category. And he worked with Robert Benchley. He co-wrote all the Benchley shorts and directed them.
Oh my God!
And then also worked all the.
I haven't watched one of those in days.
Yeah, and directed some of the Pete Smith specials. And
what do you know about that?
That's the guy. And he, and we had writers all around the house all the time. Guys like Harry Wilbur and Michael Fessier would come by and hang out, and they would talk about stuff. And as a kid, you hear everything, and you don't really know what's going to stick. But my dad would talk to me about things as a consumer. He would say, like, okay, you're in the kid demographic. What'd you think of that show? I remember we were watching an episode of Bonanza once, and he had just gotten a gig to do a Bonanza episode called Blood on the Land. And Dave Dortor, who was the exec producer on Bonanza, was good friends with my dad. And they were on the phone, and he said, well, my son really kind of lost interest when you had the fake explosion and the landslide because it looked so cheesy. And I realized many years later that was the first time my dad was sourcing me as somebody to get some feedback.
As a marketing group, yes.
Yeah, I was a one-kid marketing group, right. But he would say things, and we would talk about a film I liked. And of course, being a kid, I liked a lot of really cheesy junk. I was a sucker for bad dubbed Italian sandal and sword movies, Hercules versus the 11-headed IRS agent or whatever. And the cheesier, the better. But some of them are actually pretty good because in that group, they'd occasionally sneak in a serious film like Fabiola, where suddenly you're going, okay, this is, I mean, yeah, it's got gladiators and crap in it, but it's also, like telling a story that's really interesting. And then I went into the big, The Robe and Demetrius and the Gladiator and Cleopatra and Ben-Hur and all that stuff in the 50s and 60s.
I like the Claudette Colbert Cleopatra,
yeah,
but go on.
Oh, yeah. Well, Henry Wallach Oxen is a great actor.
Oh, yes.
So anyway, I ended up kind of absorbing all this stuff like a sponge. And things that my dad would say to me came back later. I remember I was talking to a group of writers a while back, and I said something that my dad said to me that I don't even remember how young I was when he said it. But he said it, and one day I'm talking to a bunch of writers, and my dad's voice comes out of my mouth, and I say, well, if you're not doing action, you're doing talking heads. And if you're doing talking heads, they better be saying something important. And it was weird, because around the room, people were going like, wow. And now that's something that I had ingrained in me my entire life, which is if you're doing dialogue, it better serve a purpose. It better drive the story. It better flesh out a character. Or at the very least, be a little comedic relief and be charming. And so when I started writing Magician, I remembered something my dad said. You got to give the reader somebody to root for. So I took this kid, I put him on the beach, and I drop him in a world of hurt. And that wasn't the original beginning, by the way. The original beginning was actually something that ended up being in King's Buccaneer, which was the pirate raid. But as I didn't know how to write a novel when I started Magician, I kept coming up with problems where I said, I need to go back and start earlier. And it started off with Arutha being the main character in the book, but by the time he needed a sidekick to go on this quest. And by the time it got to where the character was Pug, then the entire story, the trajectory of the story arc changed. And it suddenly became about Pug and magic. And then my friend Steve, who is basically the godfather of McKeemy and the guy who co-wrote the Chronicles with me, Steve Abrams said, well, as long as you're doing this historical thing, why don't you tell the story about how the greater magic came to McKeemy? And that's when all the lights went off and the skyrocket shot.
That's a good title, How the Magic Came to McKeemy.
Yeah, well, that's what Magician's about. It's how the greater magic came from the Serrani world to McKeemy.
Yeah.
The lost magic. The magic that was lost during the Chaos Wars when the God of Magic died. And, suddenly all the stuff that had with Arutha and the quest and things got woven into other stories so that the actual original concept of what I thought Magician was going to be back when I started writing it is what King's Buccaneer turned into, which was, abduction, go across the ocean, rescue the princess, bring her back. So ideas
and you can
died.
See more D&D derivation in that storyline than one can in the Magician itself.
Well, yeah, but I think that's
you learned your craft.
Well, that's a cart before the horse thing in the sense that I think that when you say something like that, you say, well, that's a trope that was often used in gaming, but it's a trope that came from literature to gaming.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. I agree. But I was thinking in terms of you started a story where it needed to start.
Oh,
you
yeah.
figured that out. You worked it out. And then you went to the story that you knew, which was the more swashbuckling epic.
Yeah, I really have a problem with books that expect me to, you know, endure a leisurely kickoff. You know, it's like, you better get me interested within the first chapter. I mean, I've read some interesting things that I waded through the first 150, 200 pages, and then finally, okay, it was worth getting there. But that's not often. Usually, if an author doesn't have something to say that I want to hear, you know, by the first 50, I kind of go, okay. I got an interesting email from a Facebook page thing. Somebody posted, I'm 300 pages into this book, Magician, and I'm still not in the least bit interested in any of these characters. Should I keep trying? And, of course, I didn't answer. Somebody else did. But I said, my point was, I said, honey, if I haven't caught you in 300 pages, give it up. Go do something else. Because it ain't ever going to work.
And actually, my first question is, you're 300 pages in. You must be finding something of merit.
Yeah.
300 pages is longer than any book Heinlein wrote before 1960 and so on and so forth. It's a good length.
Well, it's interesting because we had a chat about Heinlein over on the Science Fiction Forum and SFNet. And one of the points that was made was that it may very well be that the so-called juveniles that he wrote and then the early stuff in the late 50s, early 60s, one of the reasons why they may have been so effective was he was constrained by the fact that in the reality of science fiction publishing, it was like you have X number of signatures of paper to, you know, if you can't bring that book in so that it casts off at like 165 pages, we're not going to publish it.
Yeah, I think it was about 180, but that includes all the leaf.
Yeah, and so I think part of that is you know, learning to write to the market. And that's a writer kind of, you know, writer neepery. It's about understanding what the essentials of your story are, and understanding what you can do with or do without is optional, and then what's being self-indulgent crap that you really need to cut.
Yeah, but how do you do that over a remarkable run of so many books with high page counts and keep them page turning? How many Rift War or how many Ray Feist books are there? By the way, may I say
31,
a mere 31. I love the Rift War books and all that, but I have a particular soft place in my heart for Fairy Tale.
Yeah, I had fun with that one.
That is, opposite us right now, by the way, is Margot Adler. She's in another room, and she's a pagan and all that. And she and I, she's also the creator of my radio show. Mm-hmm. Now she slums at a place called NPR, doing something called All
Step
Things
Down.
Considered.
Yeah,
yeah, really. But the and I wanted her to be here and vice versa. But Fairy Tale really gets it right.
Thank you. Fairy Tale started from like three totally unrelated ideas, questions actually. Three totally unrelated.
And by
questions.
The way, for listeners who are looking this up, it's fairy spelled correctly: F A E R I E.
Yes, the Spenserian spelling. I had three weird questions that I played with for, you know, like writers what if a lot. I mean, it's our bread and butter. And the first question that occurred to me at one point was during a Christmas thing where somebody on the radio was talking about, you know, the three magi visiting, you know, the baby Jesus in the manger. And suddenly I realized I'm X number of years old and I have no clue who the hell the magi were. I just, these three kings from the East. So, you know, I jumped on my encyclopedia and I looked it up and I went, oh, interesting. And then I got a little bit into that whole era of history and the pre, the Zoroastrian and the pre-Zoroastrian. And then all the stuff that went on with the interesting thing about them was that even though the Islamic onslaught in the 6th century, you know, was pretty unkind to anybody who wasn't a child of the book. You know, it could be Jewish or Christian, and you were okay. But boy, if you worship Dagon or Baal, you were out of luck. If you didn't convert, it was to convert or die. And except for the Magi and the Parsis out of India.
Actually, in Brooklyn, we have some synagogues like that. But
they were treated as being righteous. They were treated as being important. And I forgot the exact term that the Muslims used for them, but it was they were of God. They were considered of God. And that was the one exception.
And seriously, there is a Jewish equivalent for that, of being of God, of being...
Oh, yeah, the righteous Gentile, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then they endured. So I got that. I went, okay, fine, you know. And then a little later, I had this notion in a discussion with somebody about human social evolution. And I said, well, here's the interesting question. I said, you know, Homo erectus in one form or another has been, you know, bopping around, depending on who you talk to, between a half a million and a million years. So, you know, that's a pretty long haul. And recorded history, if we go back, you know, to the early Egyptians and the Hittites and that, I mean, we got maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years of recorded history. So the question I have is, what the hell were we doing for the first 494,000 years?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a long time to be hunting and gathering. Okay, so that question went away.
Yeah.
And then the third question was, you know, and this has been done a lot. What if fairy tales were actually true stories rather than, you know, lore and everybody cautionary tales?
And anybody who's watching Once Upon a Time or something, let's remember that this book is once before that time.
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. And then, and in fact, the show that comes a little bit closer to what I was thinking about is Grimm. You know, it's like, you know, what if all these really weird creatures actually were real, you know? And out of nowhere, I said, I know what it was. We kept building civilizations, and the fairies kept knocking them down until the magi finally shut them up.
Yeah.
Oh, but, that's it.
By the way, just one off-the-cuff thing. That's the mic. When we hit the table, we go boom to the listeners. It's okay by me, but...
Yeah. Anyway, so long story short, I ended up with that. And then, you know, that was the setting. And then I needed a story. And the story pretty quickly came about where a family... and I got really indulgent with the family. I got silly with... Because it was a California family, so I could kind of go to my own roots and pick up people I knew growing up. And, you know, the rich kid from the divorce and the father who was a screenwriter... and all of that, and the twins. And I use twins a fair amount in my books. They're an interesting... I grew up with a bunch of twins around me, so I'm always fascinated by that sort of secret language they have, especially when the girls I notice. The guys don't have so much the secret understanding each other, though they often finish each other's sentences. But the girls get right down to code. You know, wink, nod, blank, okay, fine. You know, and that was a discussion. And the idea of Sean and Patrick being basically the focus characters... And, you know, Phil being totally destroyed by his son's illness. And Patrick realizing that Sean realizing that he's got to be the brave one. And then, you know, and the little scene where Barney wishes him well and gives him the elf stone and says, I wish I had your courage, you know. And it all came together. It came together better than I thought it would. I thought it would be an okay story, but it turned out to be a story that had some resonance and some real strength to it. And I think the reason it worked so effectively is I got to the place where you didn't have to like the fairies, but you understood them.
Mm-hmm.
And the evolution when Oberon is finally defeated and suddenly Puck becomes the new Oberon, because there always must be an Oberon.
Right.
You know, the fact that you realize that the individual fairies are not the roles, and the roles are not the individual fairies, that there's this whole hierarchical thing that goes on within that culture. And that they, you know, can exist at peace if the wards are intact. And so, you know, and then of course I did the horror movie ending bit where, you know, okay, and you'll forget all this. Well, except the twins didn't forget. The twins had the elf stone, and they remembered. And I have been tempted on a couple of occasions to talk to my publisher about doing a sequel.
That would be nice. But I was going to ask you something about that horror movie ending. Did you get any complaints from people saying, I bought a book called Fairy Tale, and my God, I was frightened. This cat.
Actually, the funny thing about it is I worked my ass off on the whole thing with the, you know, the bad thing. And the bad thing was, you know, there for a variety of reasons, and one of which was to show the ultimate horror of what happened to a human who was enslaved by the fairies. The fact that he was the Indian child from Midsummer Night's Dream. And just, you know, you can't be around that kind of magic as a mortal for hundreds of years and not have it totally twist you. But the scene of the abduction, I probably the two scenes I've probably worked the most on in any book I've ever written and rewrites was The Seduction in the Barn and The Abduction. And it didn't work until I stopped describing the bad thing. When I said, okay, I'm not going to, it doesn't look like anything. It's a shadow in the corner. It's something that moves, you know. That's when it really got scary.
Yes, exactly. Enough suggestion.
Yeah.
The most evil thing, the mind's eye,
exactly,
kicks in, and it was. I read the book when it came out. I haven't yet reread it. I think I will this coming week, but it is so brilliant and evocative.
Thank you.
Do you consider your work at all Dickensian?
Not really. He was an influence. I think if you've read anything, you know, the good writers stick.
And here I'm actually talking more about craft.
Oh no, I get it.
You know, because, than
plumbing. Yeah, because because people like Doyle and Dickens wrote serials.
Yes.
You know, their stories were serialized.
And also because the name Pug.
Yeah.
Is very Dickensian. It's not Pip.
It was Pip. And then, it was my homage to Dickens. And then,
and David Lean.
And, oh yeah, my favorite version of any Dickens book is Lean's version of Great Expectations.
Yeah.
Which was Alec Guinness's first role.
Yes.
Yeah. Charming.
And he did it on stage first. That's where read Alec Guinness's biography, you'll find out about
and,
it.
But just about the
I'm
time...
I'm saying that to listeners.
Yeah, just about the time I ended up starting Magician, Alan Dean Foster's Terror and Crane came out, and it was the first of the Flinks and Pip stories. And I went, hell, somebody else grabbed Pip first. And it's funny, because I had... I never thought of that. Yeah, I had so I changed it to Pug. You know, I just wanted some nickname that you'd hang on a kid that would stick. You know, the kind of thing where, you know, well, you know, that's like a friend of mine named Clinton. You know, but everybody calls him Bud. You know, he's been Buddy or Bud since he was, you know, potty trained. And nobody calls him Clinton. And so I went with Pug, and it worked, surprisingly enough. You know, on first glance, it's silly. And the great magician Pug shows up, you know, and it's kind of, okay, fine. But it did work.
Well, it did work because, for me, Pug is the entry level that I can go along with. Now, if I want to be the great magician, this will still, you know, I'm not Ozymandias. Right. I'm not going to relate to him very well. But Pug, yeah, I can do that one as a reader.
Well, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about you got to give the audience somebody to root for. You know, by the time I got the story under control and I knew I wasn't doing the stuff that ended up in King's Buccaneer, I needed a problem for the kid at two levels. One, I needed a situational problem, which is he got trapped in a storm, and so suddenly, even though you don't know who he is very much, you're rooting for him because he's fighting and struggling and trying to survive, and he's caught out in the wilderness in the storm, and then the wild boar attacks him and all of that. But I also needed a more strategic problem, which was he's coming of age and he's got to pick a trade, or a trade picks him, as it were. And what's he want to do? And he wants to be a soldier, but he's this little guy, so he's not going to be a soldier. But the creation of that circumstance whereby Culgan can take him as an apprentice and put his feet on a path he had never thought about, I thought, you know, this is very common to a lot of youth. You know, I remember... when I was a kid, the last thing in the world I thought I'd ever do was be a writer. You know, I had several things that I thought were likely. You know, I got a degree in marketing, mass market and public opinion. I was a salesman for years. At a time, I thought I was going to go into film like my dad.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Well, I went to the work of the studios when I was 19, and...
I'm waiting for, you know, of all the properties, I mean, Rift War, everything today is based on franchise.
Yeah, pretty much.
And if they're, you know, the franchise of Rift War is, oh my goodness, what a perfect property.
Thank you. I think that, you know.
But for a one-shot movie, Fairy Tale, come on. Well, where is it? Pixar?
We always talk to people. Fairy Tale was actually optioned years ago by Columbia. And then the Heidi Feist thing blew it up. Because the producer in charge was in the book. fact, his name was in the paper. So, you know, and then they brought Lisa Henson in to take over when Peter Guber left. John Peters had just left already, and then Peter Guber left, and they, and Sony brought in Linda Henson. And the way it works in Hollywood is that if you're not over a certain threshold, the deal goes into what they call turnaround, which means they basically give you the rights back and say, fine, go away. Because if you have a hit that belonged to the previous franchise, the previous administration, they get the credit. But if it's a failure, it's on your books.
Yeah.
So there's a magic number, and I don't know what that magic number is, where they say, okay, we're X amount of dollars into this project, we have to go forward with it.
Like John Carter.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You know, which is sad because you know it's not that bad a film. It just
I like it a lot.
I don't like it a lot. I enjoyed it. I thought it was okay.
Okay.
You know, but
I like the movie making. I like that. Andrew Stanton went from Wall-E to John Carter.
Oh yeah, and in terms of the look, it was lush.
Yeah.
And my problem, of course, being a child of the 50s and 60s, I you know, it doesn't look like my vision of Burroughs in my head, which you know, but
which has much more nudity, by the way.
That too. Yeah.
And by the way, those paying attention on the radio, we're not wearing, anyway, sorry.
Yeah, don't go there.
No.
That's scary.
My filter finally kicked in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a room full of bearded men.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
Anyway, but I was going to say, no, we're always talking to people. We have deals in negotiation even as I speak. I would say that if everything falls into place, it's conceivable that within 5 years, there could be a couple of movie deals. There could be a couple of television rights deals. There could be a couple of game deals. And Fairy Tale could be one of them. But I look at it this way. Having been a child of Hollywood, when somebody says to me, how are the negotiations going? My usual answer is they bought me a nice lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to a really nice restaurant in West L.A. You know, or we met, you know, in Santa Monica, and we went to a nice little cafe. Because you know, everybody wants everything for free. Everybody wants wants to tell you that you're a genius, and
frequently the writer's at the bottom of the barrel.
Oh, the writer's always at the bottom of the barrel. I've had more people pitch me where they're saying, "Well, but we can't pay you for this option, but we'll cut you a really good deal on the back end," which is what Eddie Murphy called monkey points. You know, and you know, it's like, yeah, fine. The reality for me is that if somebody is willing to, you know, put their money where their mouth is, then we'll take the whole thing seriously. But the thing I understand that a lot of writers don't, because I did grow up in the business, is that when I was a kid, especially right before the studio system broke up, if my dad wanted to make a movie, he basically had to get four people to sign off. The studio head, the money guy, the finance guy, usually somebody in a production office with some juice. You know, one of the independent producers who was renting space there, and then maybe get a name attached, either a star, or
a star director.
Yeah, you know, whoever. But mostly back in those days, it was get an actor.
Yeah.
Today, you've got to probably get 40 green lights. 40 different people have to sign off. Not one of whom ever got fired for saying no. And the risk versus reward is such that you understand why they're doing really silly remakes, because they already own the rights. And all they have to do is dust off the script, maybe revise it a little bit.
Remove the humor.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, why, for me, it's things like Van Zandt's remake of Psycho was the absolute worst possible example of how
listeners, my head is in my hands.
Yeah, it's like, why bother? I mean, if you're going to Hitchcock's storyboard and you're matching it shot for shot, the only way it makes sense is if you have a better actor than Anthony Perkins and a better actress than Janet Leigh
and Vera Miles and
Martin Balsam. You know, you and unless
or
you
a better source than Robert Block.
Right. And you know, it's they were using the same script.
And I'm very, very pleased that movie did not earn out.
Yeah. But they remade RoboCop, you know, and it's like I'm sitting there going, okay, what's next? You're going to remake Buckaroo Banzai?
That turned up on my blog recently, that very, very title. Lithgow's game.
Yeah.
So
Because one of the things about...
But W.D. Richter, yeah. Well, anyway, let's not get into...
Well, the thing about Banzai, for instance, was that that was Fox trying to manufacture a cult hit.
Yeah.
And they did, but not the way they wanted. And they even had done pre-production work on Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League. Mm-hmm. And Banzai fandom was just crazy trying to do... And here's the thing I always wonder is that that was just before the internet blew up. So a lot of it was mailing lists and pamphlets, and you'd go to midnight theaters and there would be a Save Buckaroo Banzai flyer. And I wonder today...
There were little... I have the little yellow ribbons that people were handing out. He gave me the bandana.
I don't think I have any more, but I got a Banzai hat from a buddy of mine at Fox. Yeah. And I worked at Fox for a while, so you know, getting back on topic, I think that the problem here is simply I need a really creative deal with somebody who is willing to understand that this isn't a money in the bank automatic I don't have to work proposition. It's a property that will actually take some nuance, take some care, but if it does, it'll pay off. Because I look at what George has done with Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I look at what Peter
Jackson... But that only took him 40 years.
Yeah, well, actually, he didn't write Game of Thrones 40 years ago. 40 years ago, John...
But 40 years in Hollywood. 40 okay. years of... Well, 35 years.
Yeah.
Between Beauty and the Beast and Twilight Zone, etc.
Right, but but the thing is when...
Doorways.
Right, when George left, you know, he was pretty done with Hollywood. He was very happy to get back into writing prose. And the first thing he did that I remember after that was Wild Card, you know, and then by the time he got into Game of Thrones, he had sort of, you know, gotten his voice back as a novelist. But look how long it took Tolkien to get to the big screen in a live action film, you know. So I look at what Jackson did with the Tolkien franchises, and I look at what they're doing with Game of Thrones, and I realize that, you know, it could be anything. I mean, God forbid it's another, you know, remake of Ursula Le Guin's
Or
the River World, or, you know, it would be nice to get a Game
from of Thrones. From the Syphilis Channel,
yeah,
yes.
It would be nice to get a Game of Thrones result or a Lord of the Rings result, but not being a producer, you know. I mean, there is one project.
Allegedly, American Gods is going to be an HBO project.
Yeah.
But Gaiman has already proven himself
Ironic is the only project I'm attached to as a producer is one that's in negotiation I can't talk too much about. But it's not a fantasy project. It's not a science fiction. It's a kind of a crime drama. It's set in a strip club in Miami called Illusions.
That is fantasy.
And that's the point. Okay. It's like I made the pitch on the basis of, for most people, a strip club is about as alien a culture as you're going to run into. And, of course, it's not that the story takes place only in the strip club. It's simply that all the stories intersect in that club. But it's about mobs. It's about crime. It's about political corruption. It's about the dancers and the customers and all of that. And I'm attached to that one as a consulting producer. But if we did a TV show based on Krondor, for example, I would probably consult. But I don't have, you know, either the patience or the expertise. George went through that grinder the way my dad went through that grinder. I asked my dad once what the closest example he could come up with to episodic television was. You know, and without hesitation, he says it's making sausages. We're just grinding them out. He said, "You hope that every sausage is good, but they not always are."
Yeah.
You know, my dad worked on some interesting shows. He worked on Voice of the Bottomless Sea. He worked on he did the pilot for Sea Hunt.
Okay.
He directed some Voice to the Bottom of the Sea with Rowan Allen, was exec producer on a show called The Californians, the star of whom, unfortunately, Dick Coogan, just died this last week.
Oh.
And 99.
Good for him.
Yeah. And charming guy. I could tell Dick Coogan stories for an hour, but a wonderful guy. And my dad came into that show, for instance, when they decided to fire the lead actor, a charming young guy named Adam Kennedy, who played the sort of forthright newspaper publisher on the Barbary Coast, you know, in California during the Gold Rush era. And he was a really good guy, but he just couldn't carry the show. And so they went for this character of Matthew Wayne, who was played by Dick Coogan, who was... Everybody said, well, he's a knockoff of Marshall Dillon. It wasn't, but I could see the similarities. But once they turned it into basically a Western with a cop, the show flew. It needed 54 episodes. you know, with Dick. Mm-hmm. And then two with an unknown actor named James Coburn, who was brought
in. He was always doing the Schlitz thing on camera, so.
But who came in at the time because Dick walked off the set and said, "I'm done." They had a fight over some paycheck or something, and Dick had made tremendous amounts of money in real estate already anyway. And the thing nobody knew about him is he didn't want to act; he wanted to be a golf pro, which is what he went and did. He left acting, did a couple of things for another 5 years, guest shots, you know, on TV. But mostly was on the range driving and practicing his putting and stuff. And he got a PGA card. And he was a teaching pro up in Sacramento for years before he came back to L.A.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. How wonderful. Yeah. So I like going to a nunnery and finding out that this Mother Superior was opposite Elvis in a couple of films, yeah. Which is a true thing.
Yeah.
No, we're not stopping yet. We started 15 minutes late, and this is a 90-minute radio show. So we are going to continue until the sound people say, you've got to go. I know it has to close down at 1, but we were nice to Michael Flynn. Lunacon will be nice to us for about 7 more minutes.
Sounds good.
So
I can kill that in an hour.
Yeah. And we could go 8 hours and... Scratch the surface and discuss it.
Yeah, eight hour conversations take place in the bar.
Well, this is a late night radio show, okay. So it's almost the same thing. But okay, here stock questions of mine: A, short fiction versus long fiction.
Long fiction is much easier. You get expansive areas in which you can really linger and short fiction is structured. A good short fiction is essentially structured like a joke with a punchline. You know, you need to set up what you're doing and then get to the end of it and deliver. I don't do short fiction.
You've done some.
No, I don't think it's my strength. The stuff I've done, I've had fun with. I did a story for Lynn Abbey for her Thieves World Resurrection when I said, okay, I'll do it on two conditions. One, you've never had a story about a thief. In all of the volumes of Thieves World, there's never been a thief. And... every bloody character you've ever used has magical powers, so I will only do it if I can write a story about a thief with no magical powers. And so that's when I did The Last Job, and that one I think really, you know, paid off. I liked the way it ended, and Lynn was pretty happy with it. I did a Dominic Flandre story for the...
That's right. I loved it.
Well, it hasn't been published yet, I don't think.
Wait a minute.
Or if they have, they haven't sent me my copies.
Oh, okay.
But I did, it's for the Tribute to Paul Anderson collection that Karen Anderson and Greg Bear put together.
Okay, I have seen elements of that.
Yeah, and so I did a story called A Candle, which I won't spoil because it's got a trick payoff at the end. And that was fun. You know, working in somebody else's vineyard is a challenge. You want to respect the original craft. Paul and I used to get into arguments about certain things, and politically he was somewhat to the right of Attila the Hun. And
but he was nice about it.
He was a sweet guy. And all of our political arguments were like very, very polite and very, very calm and reasoned. But he always had this image of Flandre's universe of being, you know, basically, you know, late imperial Rome when the Visigoths and the Vandals are showing up. And that Flandre was trying to hold back the darkness. And I always said, yeah, but, you know, the people who were coming after him was another empire. You know, and they're so in my version at the end, the other guys are starting to fall apart too, so maybe the empire isn't going to totally collapse. Maybe it's going to retreat and become a little core thing, but very much like what Asimov did with the Foundation stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had fun doing that story, and then I did a couple of stories set in the Machemia universe, and one with Janny. For a collection that Al Serantonio edited.
And this segues to my next question, because we've got like 4 minutes left. Mm-hmm. Collaborations. You, Jenny Wirtz, and you have shared your world and your creations generously with other writers.
Well, I did the collaborations for a couple of reasons, one of which is was business, and it's very long and involved, and I'll try to do a digest, which was that I got offered to do a gig with,
and I actually read about this on SFF.
Yeah, another,
so it was a leading question.
Another publisher who wanted to steal me away from HarperCollins. And Jane Johnson basically said, no, we will not let any other publisher in the world publish you, period. I'm their senior author, by the way. HarperCollins has published me longer than any other writer they've got. They got some people who were published before me that are still in print, but they're not working anymore. So I'm now officially the old fart at HarperCollins. And when we did the original pitch, it was they wanted to do a franchise thing, like, you know, like Cussler did with some books, and like Ludlum did with some books, and you know, the Spec Ops stuff and all that. And I said, no, if it's got my name on it, I'm gonna be working on it. But I can bring aboard some writers I like. So I contacted Joel Rosenberg, because Joel and I are old friends, and then I got in touch with Bill Fortune, because I really thought his Lost Regiment stuff was brilliant. And then I also liked Steve Sterling's, you know, Island Out of Time stuff. You know, his Nantucket goes back to, you know, the Bronze Age. And So I got on the phone with Joel, and that was a no-brainer. And then he said, it was weird how everybody sort of had the same thing, which was that I started off with Joel, and he said, well, I want to do a murder mystery. And I said, well, that's what I had in mind. Wow. So Murder in Lamont was really easy. When I saw Bill, he said, I'm having a senior moment here. The Greek general who was working with the Persians, who had to fight his way back...
He was number 299, yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. Begins with an A. Okay. Anyway, he said, I want to do that guy, the guy Xenophon, and, you know, fighting his way back across Persia after Cyrus died, and suddenly surrounded by enemies, and he's got to fight his way home. And I said, well, yeah, but I want to do Sharp's Rifles, you know. So we sat down and we conspired, and that's how Honored Enemy came to be. And of all the collaborations I've done, that was absolutely the most fun. And then the last one was, Jimmy the Hand. And I love Steve's work, but, you know, he handed me a book that had absolutely zero resemblance to the outline. I mean, it had nothing to do with what we agreed on. And I had 1 week to rewrite it and get it in. And I also learned, never ask a guy who's never had children to write about kids.
Good rule.
Yeah.
We have about 2 minutes left. Okay. I'm horrified to say. Let me ask you, for those six listeners out there who have not read your work, what is the entry point? Where should they start? Is it Magician?
Magician is absolutely the entry point for the entire series. I've made two other jumping endpoints. You can jump in with either Shadow of a Dark Queen, or you can jump in with Talon of the Silver Hawk.
Yeah.
And I guess you could even, you know, jump in with Rise of Dread Legion, though that might be a little more confusing. But Talon's a good place to start, so's Shadow, and but Magician's the grandfather of them all.
And I think that's great closing notes for listeners, because, yeah, if you haven't done it, go there. Magician is just a page-turner. I don't care. If you don't like long, epic fantasies... I don't care. This may not turn you into a fan of some of those, but it will turn you into a fan of the Rift War cycle.
Well, thank you.
So I can't say thank you enough. I'm sorry that we didn't have double the time.
Well, my pleasure. Maybe we'll do it again sometime.
That would be lovely. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was just a bit premature outroing there, but... it's what was queued up next, and it has a decent idea. But we actually have like a minute and a half before we get on the air. Can't tell you what we're going to be doing next week. This week, my guest was going to be David Edison, and we have to reschedule. I think he's out of town next week. Next, if nothing else, we're going to have to do a memorial tribute to a person who died today, Lucius Shepard, who had been on the program a couple of times and was... one of the progenitors, I wouldn't say of cyberpunk, but of that movement that came along when postmodern science fiction, William Gibson and all those people came along, and he changed many, many lives in the way many people think of science fiction, and he did so with The Jaguar Hunter and... a series of books. He was also the single most, no offense, Stan Persons or other people, single most discerning person about cinema. I don't know how he knew everything that he knew. But at one point he told me, oh, in about a year there's going to be a movie opening called The Truman Show. And that one's going to have a killer script. That one's going to be great science fiction. It's like, really? You know? And he said, yeah, it stars Jim Carrey. And I said, forget it! Forget it right there. It can't be any good. And Jim Carrey, in fact, is, I dare say, the weak point of the movie, although he does a decent job. Occasionally, he does go over the top, and that sort of kills the spirit of the movie. Despite that, the script by Andrew Niccol, who had first done Gattaca, was dynamite. And it was Lucius who was a sort of bird dog for finding what was great in literature, great in movies and various media. He is not the healthiest of people, and this, I don't know what he died of, but while I am shocked and saddened to hear of his death, he was not elderly. By the same token, I'm not thoroughly surprised that it occurred, knowing about all the different medical issues that he had been facing. So if I have nothing else coming up, we will be doing a tribute to Lucius Shepard next week. This has been Hour of the Wolf, sort of. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Ray Feist, for that spiffy interview. And only count the last hour, the part from 2 a.m. on. Forget the first hour. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister. Yes, he is here. He is live. We are not going to have to play those other things. So, have a good morning. Take care, everybody. Stephen Fry has a sign-off line that I really like, which is, be good to each other. And I like that one. So take note. Be good to each other. Have a good morning.
there. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the fisher.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. Lister's back right here at 99 Sinker. Lister Live. Pacifica Radio at its very best right here. You're tuned to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, y'all. Hey, y'all. The music that they banned, the music that they banned on, the music that they banned on Black Radio, right? Yeah. How you know that? How you know that? Yeah, they did, didn't they? Playing the music they refused to play on all the regular shows right here. That's why we had to call the show Burn Baby Burn. Max, thanks very much for sitting in last week. Jim Freund, thanks for sitting in last week. Burn, baby, burn. I know that the love is always you, but what are we supposed to do? Give thanks to the Father up above for giving us this time to love. Hey, you want to know where I was? Well, I was on the beach of Fort Myers. I had a devastating good time, and I'm using that word devastating real good. It was fun with Melody Brown. Hey, running on the beach and all that. Philip Smart's funeral in Fort Myers was pleasant and nice and short, y'all. Missed you. But it's so much things that you and I could do to help this situation. Instead of talking heavy on the books and stirring up the nation. I know that the love is always you, but what are we supposed to do? Give thanks to the Father up above for giving us this heart to love. Melody Brown, it was fun with you on the beach. This song is for you.7 minutes after the hour. 99 Sinker, the buddy system is hard and stiff, y'all. Hey, feels like 40 something degrees on the outside right here in New York City. WBAI.RJ.
Pussy. I'm here.